You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nearly half of the women in U.S. prisons are of color. More than two-thirds of them have experienced domestic or sexual abuse, and an even greater number are the primary caretakers of children. Their security is not guaranteed when they're behind bars, and human rights violations are common, with the women having little opportunity to protect themselves. A new book called Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons, offered 13 women the opportunity to write about their experiences in the system. It was compiled and edited by Robin Levy and Ayelet Waldman, and it's published by Voice of Witness in partnership with Justice Now. Ms. Levy and Waldman join me now, along with Tina Reynolds, co-founder of an organization called Worth. She's a former victim of prison abuse. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having us, Leonard.
Robin, let's begin with you. Who came up with the idea for this book, and how did you get involved in the project?
Well, Ayelet and I have worked together in the Bay Area on various issues, and I've taught at her class on the war on drugs. And we thought that this was a topic that was really ripe for the long-form narrative that Voice of Witness provides, because it gave us the moment to not just talk about the abuse that the women experience in prison, but her whole life before she came into prison, and then, hopefully discussing what has happened and what she's been able to do since then, and sort of in moving on and in her survival. And also, of course, because this is an issue that is just not discussed nearly enough, and people don't seem to know what is going on inside the prisons and who is in our prison system.
It's kind of shocking, actually. But you completed 70 interviews with over 30 people and then decided that you would stick to just a few. I would assume that pretty much every story was powerful.
Yeah, and we were actually just discussing that before we came in. It was incredibly difficult, obviously, to pare it down from those 30 individuals who we spoke with. And everyone had a powerful and compelling story, and we wanted to include everyone. But we had to make decisions in terms of length, and so we tried to make sure that we were representing a variety of abuses, a variety of geographic areas, and a variety of experiences coming into prison. At the same time, because these women have really shared of themselves, of their time, and of their life experiences, we are going to ensure that all the narratives, that even those that were not published, will be on the Justice Now website as of, I think, the end of February.
Were they eager to open up to you? I'd assume some of them were reluctant to tell some of these stories.
They were remarkably generous. I mean, that's the one thing that was, I think, the most astonishing experience that Robin and I had editing this book, was the generosity of the women who shared their stories.
Although I'm sure some of these were speaking up for the first time.
Many of them were speaking up for the first time. And what was so incredible about it is this was a huge endeavor. I mean, you had to be available to sit for 4, 5, 6 hours with someone and tell the most intimate details of your life, the most traumatic experiences of your life, many times to tell it in the prison visiting room, where you're surrounded by other people, where you're surrounded by guards, and to open yourself to be so vulnerable in such an unfriendly situation was really, it was a feat of remarkable courage on the part of these women.
Well, considering some of the stories you tell here, were prison authorities welcoming? Were they happy?
Robin, you want to take that one?
They were, obviously the opposite of welcoming. And I would say I was fairly naive. I've been doing work in the prison system in California for more than a decade, and I know that it's difficult to get in. But the difficulty and the obstacles that were put in our place throughout the country was actually shocking to me. It was enormously difficult to get into many prison systems, and some it just was flat out impossible. The ability to bring in recording equipment varied greatly.
My favorite thing about this was, so California would let us bring in recording equipment, but their regulation stipulated a certain kind of recorder. A micro cassette recorder, right?
Mini disc.
So those recorders are obsolete. They're unavailable, and that's the only thing they would let us bring in. So we had interns scouring eBay to try to find this obsolete technology, because that was the one thing the prison would. And we considered ourselves lucky, because most of the time we couldn't even bring in a recorder. So we had interviewers hand transcribing hours and hours worth of interviews, because it was very important to us that these women's voices be their voices and not digested by an interviewer, but actually really their first person narrative. It was amazing.
It was, and actually, we put a whole section in the appendix about the barriers to communicating, because while it was inconvenient to me to be constricted to just a 10-minute phone call, which would be absurdly expensive because of the collect call rates, to someone, a family member who's trying to maintain family ties, it makes it impossible. And then the communication, the letters pieces, this is another just, you know, war story that I had to share, and that we were asking, because of the difficulties in getting in, we tried to do some letter narratives with folks where we sent in questions. And so because we're asking to do this as a sign of respect, of course, I sent in 10 sheets of loose leaf paper and a self-addressed stamped envelope. And that was confiscated in one state. And then they
contraband, as if it was, I don't know, I keep saying, what did they think it was? Blotter acid? I mean, who knows?
It was. Like,
could he use it to dig your right,
exactly.
yourself out of
pulp
the cell?
Yourself, you know.
These are some of the challenges that family members have, even when they want to visit their loved one inside.
But I assume, Tina, it's also frustrating for you when you are inside, when you some of these rules just seem so silly. Right.
It's a hurry up and wait situation if you are incarcerated, and it's the same for family members when they come in, especially if they're bringing in your children. Imagine your children having to be searched and not really understanding why all of a sudden you're allowing this stranger to touch you when in all cases, when you're being raised as a child, your parent is telling you, you don't talk to strangers, you don't let strangers touch you, and you're only going to visit your mom.
When were you first incarcerated?
In the 80s, I began my criminal justice involvement, became a consumer of the correctional system.
For what kinds
and
of
I'm
crimes?
Glad you're laughing. I didn't buy into it at all. You know, I had a dear friend that used to say I became a consumer of the correctional system.
How old were you at the time?
I was around 21. Mm-hmm. I was around 21.
And was this drug related?
Of course, of course. And even at that time, you know, you think about the 1980s, there were only 34 female-only correctional facilities in the nation, and there were only 12,000 women in prison. Now we have over 1 million women in prison or either under some type of criminal justice confinement, parole, probation, and in federal prison.
In the book, some of the women say they were raised with the understanding that certain things like sexual abuse and arrests just happen. Is that something that you were aware of when you were there? I mean, did people talk like that?
Through their own experiences, did women share that those, well, you know.
Because they were going through some of these things.
Yeah,
prior
to coming to prison, they were going through some of these things. Mostly women have been abused and traumatized during early childhood. There was a study called the ACE study. Well, there is a study, the ACE study of childhood trauma. And it's just 10 questions of what a child might have experienced in their home. And I have given that to the women that are in our course where we facilitate in Bayview Correctional Facility. And all of the participants answered 8 of the 10 questions that they had had some form of trauma, had experienced some form of trauma.
I wonder if PTSD is an issue with some of these people.
Sure. Trauma is exacerbated in prison because you don't have those outlets where you can really talk to someone and heal. It's about healing. I think sharing the stories in this book is so important because it's cathartic. Mm-hmm. It gives women an opportunity to share and become visible.
Now, you may hear about prisons, but not much from prisoners, and certainly not from women prisoners. Which makes Inside This Place Not Of It, the book we're discussing, so unusual. And I'm speaking with two people, the compilers and co-editors of the book, Robin Levy and Ayelet Waldman, and also with Tina Reynolds, who's co-founder of an organization called Worth, which I assume you were inspired to do, become an activist after you had your own terrible experiences within the system.
Exactly. I think I was propelled after my last arrest. It was a violation, and I was pregnant. And I was shackled and handcuffed when I had my son in 1994.
Well, we'll talk about some of the things, some of the humiliations that people go through when we return after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're talking about a book called Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons, published by Voice of Witness, with its compilers and editors, Robin Levy and Ayelet Waldman. Also with us is Tina Reynolds of an organization called WORTH, which stands for Women on the Rise Telling Her Story. Now, the first narrative in the book is that of Olivia Hamilton, who was sent to prison for a nonviolent crime, embezzling money from her employer in order to pay the bills. What percentage of the women behind bars are there for nonviolent crimes?
The majority, the vast majority are there for nonviolent crimes, mostly drug-related, but also there are many survival crimes, like what you have for Olivia Hamilton, who was working two jobs at that point of time. And her husband had been laid off, and she was trying to make sure that she could pay her bills.
She was a Katrina refugee, and so the family had been economically devastated. Mm-hmm. And her crime was essentially embezzlement of a fairly small amount of money. I think it was about
$1,500.
When she entered prison, she was 6 months pregnant, but she was given a top bunk. Was that a way of punishing her further, or just people totally insensitive to the situation?
You know, in many cases, it's hard to tell. In that situation, it was total insensitivity. In many cases, it is purposefully used as a punishment. If you talk back or you request something, then you will be punished by getting a top bunk, by getting a work detail. We've had, not in this book, but I've talked to women who've been put in the cosmetology lab when they're pregnant and then are breathing in fumes because they have complained about something.
We even have instances where guards have been specifically given training in post-traumatic stress disorder to open their minds and to teach them how to handle women who've gone through, who are suffering from PTSD, many as a result of childhood sexual trauma. And we've had cases where the guards have used what they've learned in those training programs to further traumatize the women. So, for example, they're taught that loud noises, being woken up from a deep sleep, is especially traumatic to someone suffering from PTSD. So what they will do is they'll go and they'll slam on the bars of her cell or the door of her cell to wake her up in the middle of a deep sleep, specifically to further traumatize her.
Just because they have sadistic impulses?
Because it's power. It's ways of controlling the population.
Now, in the case of Olivia, she also wasn't sent to a doctor for a month. I would assume that women in prison would get some decent diet and improved health care, no?
Especially if they're pregnant.
You would hope. It's the opposite. The level of medical care in our prisons is shocking. I mean, you know, we live in a country where nobody is entitled to medical care anyway, but in the prison system, it's the worst of the worst.
A few of the contributors reported that the female guards were often tougher on the women than the male guards. Was that your experience, Tina?
I don't recall anyone being any tougher than the other. Uh-huh. I thought it was tough throughout the whole experience. Mm-hmm. But the resistance of the women behind bars, the silent resistance, in that story in particular, when Olivia was bunked with another sister, she gave her bed, mm-hmm. you know, and that wasn't what she was supposed to do. She was assigned the lower bunk. And it's
of
that
course,
type
Olivia
of,
was going to have to climb to the upper bunk.
Right,
six
but it's
months
that
pregnant,
type of that, resistance that women inside offer each other.
And that we saw that time and time again within this book is the community of the women inside and the support that they gave to each other. One person described it as her band of sisters, and you could always see that in terms of the people you hear who were able to overcome their drug addiction while they're inside prison. It was through the support of the other women inside that they're able to come through and do that. And
we have many stories of sexual violence in the book, but the thing that is really important to note is that women in prison aren't suffering from sexual violence at the hands of other fellow prisoners. They're suffering at the hands of guards, of prison personnel. That's who sexually abuses women in prison.
But even on another level, Olivia begged to have her shackles removed during childbirth, and the prison guard refused. And Tina, your organization has made the shackling of female inmates during childbirth a major focus. Is this something that you find all over the country?
Yes, there are only 14 states in our nation that prohibit shackling of women during childbirth and delivery and in transport to and from the prison.
And what is the argument for it? It's hard to try to escape while
exactly.
you're giving birth to a
when
child.
When you're in labor, it is pretty hard to escape.
You're
really
not
thinking about that. You're really not thinking about that. So we found that there have not been many reports of escapes during labor.
Now, Ayala, you've been on the show a couple of times before to talk about a memoir and a novel, neither of which suggested that the subject was of interest to you. Were you working on this while you were writing Bad Mother?
Yeah, we've been working on this project for a number of years. You know, I began my career as a federal public defender, so the issue of the criminal justice reform and human rights violations within the prison system is very near and dear to my heart. It does seem, you know, one of my first books was a book that was specifically about Daughter's Keeper, which was specifically about the war on drugs. But, you know, I feel like to spend my life focusing on the needs of privileged mothers, which is often what I write about, being a privileged mother myself, would be grossly irresponsible. I feel like I owe it to the community at large to raise awareness of these mothers, too.
But what about your title, Bad Mother? Are these women often bad mothers? Aren't some of them in prison because they've abused or neglected their own children or allowed a boyfriend to abuse them?
No, that's not the situation at all. And what we found is that though they are being termed as bad mothers, and that's the way the state treats them, as though they are not deserving of motherhood. And that's what you see with the shackling. The shackling is a punitive piece of you are not deserving of motherhood. The lack of prenatal care is, again, a punitive face of you're not deserving of motherhood. We had one mom ask, you know, they're doing an ultrasound on her as she's pregnant, and she said, well, how does the baby look? And they said, well, if you had cared, you shouldn't have gone to prison. And you'll see that in terms of the visitation with the children.
Oh, they take the kid of the infant away from them after
they will
just a
within
couple of
24
days.
To 72 hours, depending on the state. And and in terms of our aggressive termination of parental rights, again, it's saying to these women, you're not deserving of motherhood, and that's what we see time and time again, and it's very, very problematic.
One of the women, Victoria Sanchez, increased her drug abuse behind bars because she missed her child so terribly. How do you even get drugs in prison?
Oh. Easier than probably out on the street. I mean, it's everywhere.
Guards bring drugs in. Yeah. And that's usually what it is, you know, trading favors. But understand that in 1986, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act was passed, and punishment instead of drug treatment for street-level drug users. And so those folks were actually receiving those mandatory sentencing for simple possession of drugs. So a lot of them were women.
Now, a caller who was in jail in his late 20s points out that the targeting of certain prisoners and any other prisoners who stick up for them by guards happens in all prisons, male and female.
It's true. I think the
issue here is the way our prisons operate.
Right. I mean, it's a greater question. But the voice, when we talk about prison reform, we almost always exclusively focus on male prison, the situation of men in prison. And that's why it's so critical to us to raise awareness of women's issues in the prison system.
One of the women, Maria Taylor, describes being sexually abused by a corrections officer for years. But when the officer was finally fired by the Department of Corrections, it wasn't for sexual harassment, but rather for missing too many days of work.
Yeah. Typical. I mean, if they fired every single guard who sexually abused a woman prisoner or who exchanged sexual favors for shampoo or drugs or whatever it is, I mean, they'd have a hard time filling the employment roles.
Now, we have seen some improvements. A recent article in the New York Times discussed an unusual residential alternative to prisons in which mothers charged with felonies are allowed to live with their children to avoid their placement in foster care. It's called the Drew House, and it's in Brooklyn. It's the first of its kind in New York State. Are we seeing these in other places as well?
Let me address that quickly, and then I want Tina to tell us a little bit more about the Drew House or something like that. But, you know, we are seeing more of a movement to think about that because of the economic crisis. But I think that what we need to do is really make sure that they are separate from the correctional system. Because once the correctional system gets part of it, then it, again, becomes punitive. And there's very few of those out there. There's only one reentry program in California that really has that space to let women grow and be with their children. And we've had women in mother infant care programs in California refuse to go because it's such a punitive environment and they fear for the safety of their children.
And Maria Taylor and many others in the book describe their efforts to help other women after being released. This is something that we also don't think much about, Tina. This is part of what your organization is all
exactly,
about.
Exactly. We work in Bayview Correctional Facility, and we assist women who are reentering. And we offer them a safe space within our office for them to come to because women need that safe space. And they're amongst women who've had the same experiences. And that's important because then you can feel as if you're not bound by a certain level in which you have to be or act. And you can just be yourself.
Now, when you founded Worth in 2004, were there a lot of people who said, gee, we want to help and offer you funding?
Oh, yeah. Well, not funding. But a lot of people said they wanted to help. There were 15 formerly incarcerated women who were at the table, who were working in human service and criminal justice fields, who felt like their voices were missing from the conversations, or either our voices were a part of how we were victimized. And we wanted to shift it. We wanted to change it. We wanted to share our stories so that we could add a face to our issues and lessen the invisibility of women in prison, but also add the solutions that we feel need to happen mm-hmm. within prison and both when we come home.
Well, if a listener is moved by these stories, is there anything that he or she can do?
Give him your website, Tina.
Yes, www.womenontherise-worth.org. We're located on 122nd Street, 171 East 122nd Street between 3rd and Lex. And we're open every day from 10 to 6.
And, you know, I'd urge you, if you're listening to this in New York or if you're listening to it around the country, to find out what's going on in your state. What are the shackling laws in your state? What are the abilities for children to call their parents? What are the visitation laws? And get involved in that and see what you can do. Because I think if our legislators start hearing that people are thinking about this population, then they might start voting in a way that suggests that we care and that we really see this as something that needs to change.
Robin Levy and Ayelet Waldman compiled and edited the stories that are in Inside This Place, Not of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons, published by Voice of Witness. And Tina Reynolds is the co-founder of an organization called Worth. And I thank all three of you for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.